The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. School is now in session. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Mark Durkin.
Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I am Headmaster and host Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's a privilege to join you here every Saturday evening on AM 1280 The Patriot. And of course, I'm joined in studio once again here with the producer of Education Nation and my co-host, Mark Durkin.
And a good evening to you, Rebecca. I'm liking this schedule a lot better than
the
other
one. Yeah, there we go. Yes, it's been nice. This is our third show on The Patriot after doing about 100 shows out of KLBB in Stillwater.
Yes.
And we are very excited for this change and excited for our new listening audience to get to know us. So tonight is our first real show. The last two shows, we have been introducing our listeners to some past podcasts and some past conversations. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking forward to being able to move on to something that is current. And we're going to be talking about a Minnesota investigation in which 43 of the state's school districts and charters are under the watchful eye of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights for possibly violating the state's Human Rights Act.
That's right, Rebecca. According to MinnPost, Human Rights Commissioner Kevin Lindsay is hopeful that all the districts under investigation will enter into agreements with the departments to, as he says, work toward reducing discipline disparities that disproportionately impact students of color, end of quote. The Department of Human Rights says they've identified patterns of discipline disparities over a five-year period, suggesting that discriminatory discipline practices are in play. And so the bottom line is work in agreement with the department or face legal action from the state.
Mm-hmm. And we can all agree that as parents, we want to see each and every student treated with dignity and respect and not looked upon more favorably over other students, regardless of race, religion, or gender. With that in mind, there are several angles in play that are contributing to the tension when it comes to issues of disciplinary action in our state's schools. Tonight, we will expound on what has just been mentioned. We will also listen to the results of research that point to the problem going much deeper than just the classroom. Joining us by telephone to discuss is Catherine Kirsten. Catherine is a writer, an attorney, a senior policy fellow, and founding director at the Center of the American Experiment, having also served as its chair from 1996 through 98. She has also served as a Metro columnist for the Star Tribune from 2005 to 2008, and before that was an opinion columnist for the paper for 17 years. She's been a guest multiple times on Education Nation and is a name that is recognized by the AM 1280 The Patriot audience. Catherine, thank you for joining us once again this evening.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And we hear your daughter's getting married in a week and a half. So we are so glad to know that you are able to be with us. And congratulations on that. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
Yeah. So in your research, you discuss three premises concerning MDHR's race-focused discipline campaign. And in number one, the teachers, not the students, are to blame for the racial discipline gap. Would you please explain why this is a key assumption pushed by MDHR bureaucrats?
Yes. Why do they assume that teachers are to blame for these racial disparities in essentially suspension
rates? As opposed to student personal conduct.
They are in they approach this from an ideological straitjacket, let's say. They simply cannot believe, despite all they have to say about diversity, that when it comes to student misconduct, there might in fact be real differences between students with widely different socioeconomic and family backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
This simply is not admissible in their mental universe. So they have to attribute the racial differences in suspension rates to teachers. And of course, part of this is the whole ideology of victimhood, the kind of grievance drumbeat that we see on the left. It's not possible that from their point of view that you know, real differences can account for the sort of disparities we see, unless there's ill will, evil intent, discriminatory action to account for them. It's really a utopian worldview.
It really is, and it ties back into a conversation that we briefly had last week with, you know, the progressive era leaning towards this notion that man is perfectible. And so, you know, if they see problems with kids, they can't imagine that it's that kids themselves, they're going to perfect the white people around them to try to make sure that the other kids, the other kids are able to then behave.
Yeah, so that's exactly right.
Man,
what could be
man.
More racist,
right.
really?
Right.
I mean, to believe that certain kids are not moral agents at all, not accountable at all for their behavior because of their skin color.
Right.
And the only people who will have agency in the world are white people. That's, you know, it's outrageous.
Yeah, it is really outrageous. Well, in your research, you found on a national scale that white boys are actually suspended at more than twice the rate of Asian and Pacific Islander boys, which, of course, is something that these same people don't want to even talk about. And then nationally, young black males between the ages of 14 and 17 commit homicide at 10 times the rate of whites and Hispanics of the same age.
Right.
And
right.
you point out that there are some real differences in group behavior, right? So
right.
according to that research you've conducted, what accounts for those group differences in behavior?
Well, you know, of course, this is a very complex matter, but it goes back to the home. I think common sense as well as social science tells us that. And in fact, a major study in 2014 in the Journal of Criminal Justice documented the fact that the root of these kinds of differences is in the home. This was an analysis of the largest sample of school-age children in the nation. And the authors found that teacher bias has absolutely no role to play in the racial discipline gap, that it all goes back to the prior problem behavior of the student. They actually looked at past disciplinary, you know, misbehavior on the part of students and discovered this. And there's other research that shows that these kinds of patterns are well established by the age of five. So kids who come to school already exhibit these kinds of group differences, clearly not a matter of racial bias on the part of teachers.
Such an important distinction, because that is not what we're hearing. The drumbeat that is out there is that it is about white privilege and not about family structure and the breakdown of the family. And so it is really important that we have these conversations. And, you know, we talk a lot at Education Nation about ideas that we can agree on. And we can all agree that we really want to see every child have the same opportunity at an excellent education. But if we can't, and if we can't acknowledge the true foundation of these differences, then we're not going to treat them properly as well. And then we're not going to help those kids in the way that they really need to be helped.
Right. And you see this when it comes to the matter of school choice, with many low income minority families choosing charter schools for their kids, charter schools with uniforms and with rules of behavior that are enforced, because they know how tough it is in this cultural environment to raise well-behaved kids.
They're desperate. And the other thing that I get frustrated about, this notion that the racial achievement gap is about white privilege, is it completely then undermines the children of color who want to learn. You know, there's a lot of black kids in those classrooms that want to learn, and they're not being given the equal opportunity to an excellent education as peers in different schools, because they've got so many other kids in their classroom that are misbehaving. And then the way the district is handling that is to not discipline those kids in the way they need to be disciplined. So they're not setting them up for success, not the kids who who are misbehaving and not the kids who are not misbehaving.
I can't imagine how exhausting and frustrating that's got to be for the teachers that are constantly have to bring correction in the classroom.
I can't imagine. I'm so glad you mentioned that groundbreaking study, Catherine, J.P. Wright in the Journal of Criminal Justice. Mm-hmm. It's really important. I hope that some of our listeners will go and look at that study. Maybe we can post that on our Facebook page, Mark. I think that would be a good one for us to share with our listeners.
We'll go ahead and find that for sure. And again, you're listening to Education Nation, where we are talking with Catherine Kirsten here on AM 1280 The Patriot. We are discussing the three premises concerning the Minnesota Department of Human Rights' race-focused discipline campaign. We've just discussed that first premise of teachers, not students, are to blame for the racial discipline gap. The second premise is that black students' higher suspension rates give rise to what's known as a school-to-prison pipeline. Catherine, would you please explain for our listeners the tenets of this premise and why that you feel it's false?
Sure. You know, the idea is that when kids are not in school because they are suspended, they don't learn, and as a result, they don't perform as well academically, and as a result of that, somehow they fall into the criminal justice system. You know, that's a bit of a stretch there, but that's the idea. That's the overall justification, claiming that, you know, to help struggling kids, we have to basically remove consequences for misbehavior in the classroom.
Right.
So a means to an end in the sense of having all discipline removed so that nobody will end up in the criminal justice system.
Basically, yeah.
Well, let me ask you, Catherine, what's the real problem that is reducing chances for future success?
Well, again, I know all of this goes back to the home. I remember when my kids were in third grade, how hard we worked to teach them the multiplication table so they could move on to fourth grade. Well, you know, kids need support at home in order to learn to read and learn to do math. And in too many cases, there's great evidence there that, you know, that many poor minority kids are not getting it. But I think one factor that is simply overlooked by the Minnesota Human Rights Department when it comes to kids' absences from school, the major problem there is not suspensions. The major problem there is chronic absenteeism.
Right.
And again, that's simply not mentioned by MDHR as a factor. And we find massive disparities there between Native American black students on the one hand and white and Asian students on the other hand.
Which once again goes back to family structure and the social factors. And, you know, if the kids aren't being brought to school, they're not being given the opportunity to get there, then how can they learn? And that is much more
who's there to
of a
lead.
Factor. Yep. Right, exactly. Well, the third premise that you talked about in your article with concerning MDHR's race-focused discipline campaign is that discipline policies that focus more on race than on a student's actual conduct somehow benefit poor and minority children. Can you explain for our listeners, Catherine, how race-based policies actually harm children as opposed to helping them?
Sure, and I think that you alluded to this, Rebecca. It's in the schools that have the biggest problem with discipline and suspensions. The demographic of the student body is more likely to be low income and minority, and it really is a small percentage of kids in those kinds of schools who are truly misbehaving and ruining the environment for learning for everybody else. For example, as I recall, back in St. Paul schools, before their disciplinary changes were made a few years ago, it was something like 15% of black students who were suspended at least once in a year. Well, that means 85% of the black students were you know, not causing the kinds of problems that presumably that led to that action. But those kids, my daughter's a teacher, and she can tell you that two disruptive kids, even one in a classroom, can totally throw the teacher off. And that's what happens when kids' behavior isn't controlled.
Right. Right. And when the teachers aren't given the opportunity to actually do the what they need to do to bring them under
control.
Bring
back the order.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, yes.
So, Catherine, the research and reporting that you've done as it pertains to the state's investigations has been met with scathing criticism from Governor Dayton's educational commissioner, as you well know, Brenda Casilius. And her charges against you are serious, and they include calling your reporting unsubstantiated, full of falsehoods, divisive, hateful, misleading, reckless, and perhaps the worst of all, flat out racist. And you also, I know, which is, I have a hard time with this because I know how well you research things. You also drew criticism from Julia Hill, a reading teacher in the St. Paul Public Schools, and Dana Bennis, the director of learning at an organization called the Institute for Democratic Education in America. So they accuse you of making false argument. But can you discuss the three reasons they give for why they see your work as contemptible? And then, of course, we'll let you respond to the facts that you've dug up.
Well, I think, Casilius is the serious critic because she happens to be the Minnesota Commissioner of Education.
Right.
So her criticism should be taken with some real weight. And what was so striking, as I read it, in fact, I was just incredulous when I read her response in the Star Tribune, is that she essentially has one argument, which is that, as you said, Rebecca, I am a, quote, flat-out racist.
Mm-hmm.
She provided no evidence whatsoever for that. And, that is a really serious charge to make about someone. And when you read into her piece, you discover that her definition of a racist is somebody who disagrees with her about school discipline policies. She went beyond that, though. She attempted to bully the Star Tribune into stop printing my work. She said that they were giving my, quote, divisive and hateful words column inches and oxygen.
Unbelievable.
Silence
the opposition.
Right, exactly.
Right? Silence.
Yeah.
Call them names and silence the opposition. How unprofessional.
It's obviously you're so right. It's unprofessional, but it's more than that. And I don't say this like this is truly un-American.
Yeah,
this has the flavor of authoritarianism hanging about it. And it's such an embarrassment, I think, for a public official to sling these kinds of charges around, to attempt to silence without responding in any evidentiary way a critic. This is deeply troubling. In fact, I found it deeply troubling that the Star Tribune would print such a thing because it really does verge on an authoritarian kind of mindset that has no place in America.
Right. Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah.
Catherine, the race-based policies the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is enforcing on Minnesota school districts has been shown to have a gloomy track record in other parts of the country. Hill and Bennis, as we mentioned those two names earlier, they endorse a discipline policy based on restorative justice peace circles. And this has actually been incorporated in another part of the country. Would you explain what these policies are, first of all? And as these were also incorporated in the public schools in Syracuse, New York, the results were disastrous. Could you explain what happened after they were enforced back in 2014?
Yes, in Syracuse. Very similar kind of story. In fact, one of the few where state officials were the cause of imposition of these race-based policies. But there, the New York Attorney General forced the Syracuse public schools to reduce racial disparities. And things just went south immediately in terms of school order. So the following year, there was a survey done by the teachers union there, which found that the district's teachers and staff members felt, quote, helpless to control students' behavior after this happened. Two-thirds of them said that they were worried about their safety, and 57% said they had been threatened by students, 36% said they'd been physically assaulted, and that included being shoved, kicked, headbutted, choked or bitten. And of course, unbelievable, crude, sexual, racist language. And also parents, they were very concerned about literally students' parents getting involved in this kind of abuse of teachers, doing things in the parking lot at the school, for example. So finally, in 2017, there was a double stabbing of a teacher, and the county district attorney called for the reversal of the 2014 discipline policy changes. This is the kind of thing I outlined.
3 years later, and it takes a double stabbing to get to that point. That's insanity.
I mean, this really all starts in the home, though. I mean, we know that for those of us who've had families, that as parents, if we restrict the discipline on kids, they're going to be emboldened to carry out behavior and actions that are going to get worse and worse. And we see
this
playing
out.
It's
human nature.
Absolutely.
Well, and once again, it ties back to this idea that progressives think that man is perfectible.
Right.
And that if we just have peace circles, we just talk about it, that the kids are going to make the right decisions, when in actuality, they need to be taught the difference between right and wrong.
Absolutely.
What is good behavior? What is bad behavior? I was just going to say, you're listening to Education Nation, and we are talking with Catherine Kirsten this evening. Go ahead, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, Catherine.
One interesting point there. I've read research which makes it clear that these so-called peace circles can actually really empower the bullies and the students who are engaged in misconduct, because they are always involved in these. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can exert their control in these circles, and the kids who've been bullied and are already afraid of them can see their power. And actually, so those kids are even more afraid and insecure at school. I mean, again, if you don't understand human nature, that you don't get that, but it's obvious to people with common sense.
Yeah.
You know, Brenda Caselius argues that Minnesota parents and community members can access discipline data through a simple search of the Minnesota Department of Education's data center. And she states that the department reports discipline data every year and summarizes them in a report to the legislature that civil rights groups like, say, the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition are using to call attention to this racial discipline gap. I will say this, Catherine, I looked at this website, and I'm sure you have as well, too. And if you remember, there's just pages of charts that give, like, the name of the school district, the particular race, the percentage of students that are attending in that district of each race, and the percentages of people that have experienced a suspension. But what it doesn't give you is the intangibles. It doesn't show you, okay, how many times was Johnny warned to stop a particular action? Was it 4 times, 5 times, 10 times before the suspension was levied?
Yep.
So when you examine those numbers, you don't have the intangibles to really put together the full thought of what's going on in these school districts. So my question is, were the other forms of discipline that were already tried before the decision to finally expel the student? I mean, we don't know. That's the problem here.
Well, that's the whole thing about the 2014 study, the prior problem behavior of the student. That is not. But you're right, Mark. But there's more, I think, confusion when it comes to that data. And the center is actually beginning to take a look at the data now and finding that it's very hard to separate these subjective and objective disciplinary matters with any clarity. It's also, you take a school like Best Academy, a charter school that was included by the Department of Human Rights as, you know, being, you know, out of line in its discipline. We're just beginning to look at this, but what you find is a school like that is almost 100% Black students. What is going on? You know, it's not clear when you look at these. Why did they choose this school? Why did they avoid that school? Another question that I asked is, if they're only looking at the so-called subjective infractions, like, you know, talking loudly, disruptive behavior, they're not telling you what the racial differences are on the objective, like the more violent infractions. Well, if those differences are out of whack racially, then why would you not expect it to be the case with subjective differences? But they don't reveal to you what those are.
Mm-hmm. Or even the subjective ones, such as talking loudly, you know, that does that talk about whether there was respect or disrespect in the tone of voice. You know, talking loudly is one thing, but talking loudly with a disrespectful tone and using disrespectful words is a really difficult matter that needs to be addressed in the classroom. So I think even discounting subjective data doesn't seem appropriate, and that's what they're trying to do, or that's what Brenda Casilius was trying to do when she wrote back. So, you know, this particular website that we've been talking about that Brenda Casilius says we can go to and that parents and community members can access, you know, does it concern you? I mean, when you think about that, this is what she's going to point to, does that concern you that that is kind of her answer as well? You can just all go look. And what are your thoughts about that?
Very much so. Very much so. And of course, keeping the names of the districts and the charter schools that were being investigated secret until the agreements to change policies had been signed, that again, is not appropriate in a democracy. Parents should know if there's an investigation of their kids' school and why, and on what basis are the authorities telling them that their teachers are racist, but they had no opportunity because this was kept utterly quiet.
It's that transparency issue again. Okay, well, you know what? We only have just a minute left here, Catherine. Can you quickly tell us what steps Minnesota parents should take in order to know what the discipline policies are that are being implemented? And then if the racial discipline policies are present, like the MDHR wants them to be, what actions can parents take? Very, very quickly. We've got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, you know, you've got to be the squeaky wheel. You've got to get to the school. You've got to document. You have to pull information together and demand fairness. Mm-hmm. And most people are intimidated. They don't want to do that when there's a question of race. But parents have to be advocates for their kids in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that is such good advice. If they do find that the racial discipline policies are present, can they go to the state? Can they complain to the district quickly? Can they do anything at all?
Well, it's hard to go to the state since it's the Department of Education.
That's true. They're the ones that are doing it. Yeah.
I'll tell you what they can do. There is a state law that's essentially supposed to make bullying, a zero tolerance for bullying. It's wholly inconsistent with this new race-based focus. So they could very much look into the kind of ammunition they could get with that anti-bullying law.
Excellent advice. That's excellent, Catherine. Well, we are so grateful to have you on the show again today, Catherine Kirsten. We look forward to having you with us again next time. And to our listeners, we hope you join us again next Saturday night, 6 p.m. for Education Nation. Check out our podcast at EdNationMN. Thank you so much.